Save It for the Blind is sponsored by Kershaw Knives. Kershaw manufactures next-level pocket knives for outdoor enthusiasts. Save for the Blind is now also being sponsored by Roseville Motorsports. Roseville Motorsports is the greater Sacramento area's premier destination for all your power sports vehicle needs. Stop in today to browse off-road vehicles from leading manufacturers like Polaris, Yamaha, and more. If you guys are enjoying the show, we'd love to hear from you and get your support. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a 5-star rating. Your reviews really help us grow and reach more people. Thank you for being a part of our community.
Yep. We're ready to roll.
You figured it out. Look at you. I hire you as the IT guy.
Mm-hmm.
That looks like a banded jacket.
Hey, you know your product.
There we go.
Yeah.
We did customize it with the logo here.
Yeah, those were the ones we got for our hunt program staff this year. We had a bunch of different designs, and they chose that one. And then we put the CWA logo embroidered on the other side. And it is
great,
warm. And it's like perfect for California because it's not too warm, but it keeps you warm in the morning, and then you can wear it most of the day. That was good. All of our hunt program staff wore it when they were running hunts.
Yeah. Good. How many kids do y'all run through your hunt programs?
In total people were about 3,000, just hunters in general. Kids, I think it was upwards of over 250,
yeah, 300 like
in terms of like total youth. Okay. So also within that is about 1,000 veterans as well. And then we have women, et cetera. Yeah. So within the actual hunt program itself, there's a couple different categories of people that we do cater specifically to. Yeah.
Yeah. Then we have our separate summer camps for kids, which we run about 15 kids a weekend and do 4 or 5 weekends of that.
So. Yeah. Okay.
Perfect.
Good?
Yep.
Cool. Well, we'd like to welcome everybody back to another episode of Save It for the Blind. Today's guest is Austin Booth, the new CEO of Banded Holdings Incorporated. So welcome, Austin. We appreciate you popping on and giving us your time.
It's really good to be on with you guys, and I appreciate you having me.
So, Austin, you've had an impressive career spawning law, military, public service, Fish and Game Commission out there in Arkansas. How did that journey lead to you becoming the new CEO of Banded Holdings?
Well, I've been really blessed professionally, and I've said for a while now that if someone just looks at my resume, they're going to think this guy has no idea what he wants to do when he grows up. And while I could relate to that, the truth is that I've had an immense blessing to only serve organizations and causes that I care deeply about. And Banded is certainly no exception to that. I was raised in a really small town in Arkansas. My dad was an engine builder. Mom was a nurse. And we grew up spending just about every moment we could outside. Had a lot of fun when I was a kid hunting and fishing. Then I moved away from my hometown in Arkansas for about 15 years. And in that 15 years, went to college, went to law school, and then took a commission in the United States Marine Corps. Traveled all over the place with the Marine Corps and learned a totally new chapter of how to hunt and how to fish. And then after it was time for me to get out of the Marine Corps, I came back to my home state of Arkansas with my wife, with my 3 kids, entered state government in Arkansas, and eventually became the director of the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. And the truth is that conservation and the outdoors have, without a doubt, made me who I am. And when I think back of some of my best memories that were foundational, and or alternatively now how I would like to spend time with my kids, 9 times out of 10 it's outside. And when it came time for me to leave the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission, because you know I'm gonna be 40 in almost 18 months, and I've always said that I want to serve my country, I want to serve my state, but I also want to be in the private sector by the time that I'm 40. When I started thinking about what industry I wanted to land in, it was near and dear to my heart to to find myself in the outdoor industry because I feel like I owe it so much. So been in the seat at Bandon since January 2025, and I'm having a great time.
Did you have a relationship with the company prior to joining?
I did not. But there were a few people in my life that did. And when I started making soft networking moves, that I was interested in at some point leaving the public sector for the private sector, it ended up being a really natural fit.
That's awesome. Can you touch a little bit about your law background and kind of how you got involved with that and, you know, the passion there of serving?
Yep. Well, I grew up, like I said, the son of an engine builder. And, you know, almost every summer that I can think of, you know, growing up was in my dad's outboard motor shop. And we were remanufacturing outboard motors and sending them all over the country. And I loved doing that, but he said, "No, son, you're going to be the first person in this family to ever go to college." And I always share that with people because it is not a credit to me, but it's a credit to my parents and what they went through to make sure their kids had more opportunities than they do. And I'm super proud of them. Got through college at the Citadel. That's a military school in Charleston, South Carolina. Went to the Citadel with the plans to serve in the United States Marine Corps. I changed my mind halfway to the Citadel and thought I would rather go to law school. So ended up going to law school at the University of South Carolina there in Columbia, South Carolina. And the more I surrounded myself with law students, I thought, you know what, I can go bill hours as an old man, but I want to do something when I'm 21 that I'm only going to be able to do when I'm a young man. So we had this recruiter that came around at law school. He was a Marine Corps major. He was in his dress blues, and I came in late for the meeting. And just like church on Sunday, when you come in late, the only place to sit is right up front. And so I sat right up front, and the recruiter, you know, typical Marine Corps fashion, inspirational but short and sweet. He says, "Raise your hand if you think practicing law in Helmand Province, Afghanistan sounds like fun." And I mean, my eyes got big and my hand went up in the air. I thought, that sounds awesome. And I turned around to the full auditorium behind me, knowing that every other hand would be raised, and there were none. And the Marine Corps major said, "All right, I need to see you up front. And for everybody else that came here for free Chick-fil-A, it's in the back." And like, that was the end of the recruiting meeting. So went to Officer Candidate School in Quantico, Virginia in 2010. Then came back to law school for my third and final year, and then reported to Parris Island, South Carolina for active duty in 2011. My first 4 years in the Marine Corps were mostly spent as a criminal prosecutor. And then I went to combat in 2015-2016 time frame. I got to, and this is really cool, and I'll always treasure it, I got to do the exact thing that Marine Corps major promised me in 2010. That would have been 2008 when he came to our law school. I got to practice law in Helmand Province, and I had an absolute time of my life over there. Then came back from Afghanistan, went to the Hill, and I was in the Marine Corps but working on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. Took me to about 21 countries after that, but haven't really practiced law since then, but I'm grateful for it.
Just out of curiosity, what does practicing law in Afghanistan entail or like? What can you tell about that?
Sure. Yeah. So my job is what we call operational law. And that is basically, how do we ensure that commanders on the ground have all the tools, all the flexibility, and a full risk assessment for how they use force. I always took the approach of, sir, ma'am, I'm not going to tell you what you can't do. I'm going to tell you what you can do, and then you can make the informed decisions as the unit commander to meet the mission. So, all right, Austin, what the heck does that mean? We would essentially do three things. We would evaluate targets that needed to be added to a list for us to go hunt down. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we would help review operations before operations took place to make sure that, no one was going to get in any trouble, or any time that there was, a firefight, troops in contact in real time, we would go advise on whatever kinetic situation that was. So did that for about 7 months.
You didn't want to be a lifer?
No. oftentimes people assume that you get out of the military because you were burned out or broken or something like that. I got out of the military because I had the best 8 years of any Marine Corps officer that I knew. I mean, I got to do everything that I wanted to do and more. I got to be a criminal prosecutor. I got to go to combat, and then, 21 other bonus countries that a small town, that a kid from small town Arkansas just couldn't even think about. And so when it came time for my wife and I to decide whether we're going to be in it for the long haul, we considered that. We considered the fact that we already had three kids, and we just didn't think that it was going to get any better to warrant the impact on our kids' upbringing. We wanted them to grow up around their grandparents. We wanted them to grow up generally with the same set of friends, to root for the same high school, all of those kind of, deep root blessings that each of us had growing up. We wanted the same thing for them as well.
And shortly after your law career, how did the Fish and Game Commission come about?
Yeah, that's a switch.
Yeah. Yeah. So the truth of it is, and when I was the director in Arkansas, I had just such a good time meeting directors from other states. And one of the things that's interesting is, of course, every state has its own culture, but every state has its own different culture around like game of fish. Or fishing game, or how they're structured, whether they're popular or unpopular. Every state is totally different. Arkansas, we have such a diversity of natural resources that the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission has a lot of pressure put on it. And ultimately, that's a good thing. And I'm sure we'll talk about that later. But when I saw the director of the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission was retiring, read about it in the newspaper, I Googled the headhunter, I found his website, I sent him my cover letter, I sent him my resume, and about 4 months later, I was the new director. Now, it was, I was the first external hire in about 20 years.
Oh, wow.
I was the youngest director in the country at the time and the youngest director in Arkansas Game Fish history. So I knew that I was a long shot, but I didn't know a rip about biology. I didn't know a rip about professional science-based conservation, but I knew how to lead a team. I grew up hunting and fishing in Arkansas, a lot of it on public land. And if I was afraid of a fight, I wouldn't have joined the Marine Corps. And conservation, when you're doing it right, is a struggle. It's a struggle against the natural resources. It's a struggle with human nature. At every single juncture with conservation, if you're doing it right, it's hard. And that in and of itself was something that attracted me deeply. And I didn't really realize the treasure that we had in Arkansas until I left for 15 years. And so to be able to leave for 15 years and do so much and be so grateful for it and come home to my home state with my three kids, I just felt a burden that I needed to give back to the state and the natural resources that I treasured.
What were some of the biggest things you saw being absent for, you know, those 15 years and then you come back? Was it, you know, did the culture change? Did the public land? Was there rules, regulations? Like, what were some of the biggest challenges that you were seeing when you came back?
Well, let's see. I left in 2004 and then came back in 2019, like months before the pandemic. And a lot changed with Arkansas waterfowl during that time frame, and really shouldn't say just waterfowl either, but I would say the biggest ones were, even before the pandemic, the cost of recreational property went absolutely through the roof. I mean, I thought that I was going to be able to like move back to Arkansas, and you know, as a young 30-something with one income, easily get a lease, right? A lease of my own. Wrong answer. and like I like hoped and dreamed about that for, you know, 15 years when I was gone. And then I come home and I start, you know, pricing stuff out. I'm like, my goodness, this has gotten out of hand. And that was before the pandemic, guys. So that was really the thing that I noticed the most right off the bat, was like, all right, the game has changed when it comes to recreational property. I mean, there were people that were paying the same amount for a flooded rice field lease in 2019 when I came back that people were paying for a flooded timber lease in 2004 when I left. And that, I mean, ultimately, look, I didn't like it, but I was fine with it because I grew up, hunted a little bit of public land in Arkansas. And then when I left Arkansas, I basically, you know, left all my hidden spots. I had to relearn every single wildlife management area that I ever hunted on the East Coast, which ultimately made me a better hunter. But I was, when I realized that I was priced out of like getting my private lease that I had dreamed about, I was totally fine hunting public land and with friends and stuff on private land. But that was the biggest thing that changed. It drove so many more people towards public land. You know, you guys know this, but like the number of hunters in the country is declining. That's an objective fact. Now in Arkansas, that gets a little bit lost in translation. With waterfowlers in Arkansas, the number is actually static. The number of resident waterfowlers is declining. But you go to public lands and the perception is sometimes there's more hunters here than there ever have been. And the reason for that is the higher that the cost of recreational property goes, the more people that it drives to public lands. So that's the first thing. The second thing from a waterfowl perspective is the state, and generally speaking, the waterfowling community in Arkansas had transitioned from, I would say, a concerned posture about habitat in Arkansas, specifically green tree reservoirs and the role that red oak dominant bottomland hardwood forests play in wintering waterfowl migration. We had transitioned as a community and as an agency from a concerned state to a extremely concerned, or you know, critically concerned state. Those were the two things that I noticed in 2019 when I moved back, and those were two of the reasons why I pursued the job.
That's pretty interesting. I still think it's amazing that you were, you know, had the drive to go straight from military to go into that position all the way up at the top for Arkansas Fish and Game, basically. And the confidence in yourself is awesome. I love people like that, that fight for themselves no matter what. And it's like, hey, I don't have the biology experience, but I know, like you said, how to lead a team. That stuff gets me fired up when I hear that, because there's so many people out there that, oh, I just don't have the piece of paper. I don't have this, so I'm not going to apply. It's like, no, if you have passion in it and like you think you can do it and you feel like, go for it.
Yeah. Well, and let me say this. I did have a job in between the Marine Corps and Game and Fish. I was the chief of staff for the Arkansas Department of Veterans Affairs. And, you know, again, I'm a veteran to be able to leave the Marine Corps and instantly serve veterans of all ages was a lot of fun. And I enjoyed it. But the more I got into state government and outside of the Marine Corps, the more, you know, I recognized that it doesn't really matter the organization. The variables that are going to contribute to success or failures are essentially the same. It's about values, motivation, resources, vision, and discipline. And that's it. And so then when I thought more about the Game and Fish job, I think we had four interviews and really wrestling with the question of what are you doing, thinking that you can run a conservation organization, not being a biologist. It really came down to the fact that the legacy of the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission speaks for itself. And that when it comes to scientific based decisions, that often the fingers in the dirt, you know, biologists are some of the best in the country. That's not, that does not capture or represent the challenges facing the agency. For the agency, at least then, it was about resources and it was about vision and it was about interaction with the public and regaining their trust, not do we have the best scientist at the top.
Yeah, that's interesting. So go there now. Obviously, currently you're with Bandit, and Bandit's been around for a while. They've built a strong reputation in the outdoor and waterfowl industry. How do you yourself continue to help evolve that brand and keep it fresh and keep it current?
Yeah. Well, I would say that we as a brand, certainly not since January, but long before I ever showed up. And one of the reasons that I've known, enjoyed, and worn this brand for years is that Bandit is a brand that was really founded on two things: on authenticity and innovation. You know, we're very proud of the fact that we were really the first company to bring breathable waders to waterfowlers. And I mean, now you can find a pair of neoprenes every now and then, but for the most part, you know, breathable waders, that's the name of the game. And innovation is really, really difficult to maintain as a cultural core value, because it's just tough. It requires you to be really in touch with your customers. When you believe in the strength of a dealer network, like we do, we have to be in touch with our dealers to understand how their needs are shifting as the consumer shifts. So right now, I would say we're in a phase where we are very much trying to emphasize our core values of authenticity, being our own best customers. We were our own first customers, and then continuing that legacy of pushing the envelope when it comes to innovation to make sure that waterfowlers, that deer hunters, that turkey hunters, that everybody has the best possible gear at an accessible price.
Exciting news. Our hunt program is now accepting applications for spring turkey and pig hunts. Visit calwaterfowl.org to apply. We're also offering free mentored turkey hunts at Sacramento National Wildlife Refuge and Delavan National Wildlife Refuge. an incredible opportunity for new hunters to gain hands-on experience in the field. Camp Sprig registration is now open. If you have a young hunter looking to obtain their hunter education certificate, we have 4 2.5-day camps designed to provide hands-on learning and certification. These camps take place June through July. While you're there, don't miss our membership deal. Purchase a membership and receive a free Realtree sweatshirt while supplies last. You can also apply for hunts, purchase tickets for upcoming events, and show your support for California Waterfowl Association. Upcoming events are Reading Banquet, April 12th, Gold Rush Banquet, April 19th, Napa Sonoma Banquet, April 19th, Lake County Recruitment Meeting and Social, April 23rd. Don't miss out. Visit calwaterfowl.org now.
And Austin, you talk about innovations. Are there any innovations that you're most excited about coming up, or even an innovation in the past that, you know, as a brand, you're most proud of?
Yeah. So I appreciate that question. The ones that I'm most excited about, I'm just not going to tell you yet. but we do have some hot stuff coming, and I'm really fired up about it. I would say the one that I am most proud of that I can talk about is we relaunched our banded waders in 2024-25 season, and our return rate on those was less than 1%.
Oh, wow.
Oh, nice.
So for the 2024-25 relaunched waders, less than 1% return rate at a very accessible price, and we're super proud of that.
Yeah, we demoed a pair of those for our waterfowl gear review, and we were just so excited on the price point, you know, because,
yeah.
God, waders nowadays, I mean, $1,000 plus, you know, it's, for most hunters, that's, you know, reaching it. But these were, I think that pair was like $175 or something like that. It's a great price point and really well-built wader. We were excited about it. But
Yeah. It, you guys have always been, banded has been, you know, contributor to conservation efforts, obviously big contributor to CWA, and we appreciate all the partnerships we've had with you guys. Why do you think, and what do you think your role is as an outdoor company, as it plays in protecting our natural resources? Because, you know, you could just go out and sell shirts and gear and not do anything, but you guys give back a lot.
Right. Well, a little bit of a civics lesson that you didn't ask for, but I'm never, ever going to turn down an opportunity to talk about it. Private industry is really what made conservation in the United States of America what it is. And for anybody that knows about the Pittman-Robertson Act, you know what I'm talking about. You know, late 1800s, early 1900s, Americans hunt game and catch fish to dang near extirpation. You know, Arkansas used to be known as the bear state because we had so many bears. They were down to less than 100 in the early 1900s. Oh, wow. White-tailed deer, basically gone. Wild turkey, basically gone. Sport fish, basically gone. And so in the early 1900s, when that started to turn around and you saw Aldo Leopold write the Sand County Almanac and some of his teaching, and then you started seeing game and fish commissions popping up. When all of that started to turn around, basically the firearms industry went to Congress and said, we want you to tax us, which is unthinkable today. Said, we want you to tax us as an excise tax, and then we want you to take the proceeds from this national excise tax on firearms and ammunition and put it in a big pot of money to give back to the states so they can put that money back into the natural resources that will then create better natural resources and future customers for us, right? And the United States of America is the only one that has that kind of consumer-funded conservation model. And it sets us apart from the rest of the world. And we should be super proud of that. So to answer your question, what role do I think private industry has in securing natural resources? A really, really big one. Now, the you know, I've said for a few years now that, that conservation really has two pieces to it. It is just as important that we conserve natural resources as it is that we raise little boys and girls to get out there and love the outdoors. And that's why I'm so impressed, so proud of the work that y'all do at CWA, because really the people component to conservation is what separates conservation from preservation. And we try to support local, healthy, conservation-minded organizations like y'all. And then we also have some natural resources programs that I can't quite talk about yet, but taking care of the natural resources that are ultimately why we're in business is what we want to do.
Yeah, no, that's, you're right on that. As the new CEO, I mean, what do you think some of the biggest challenges that you're going to face in the waterfowl industry coming up?
Well, I will approach this in the same way that I approach conservation in the last question. Natural resources wise, at least in the Mississippi Flyway, habitat is declining at a faster rate than ever. I mean, for decades, Canada has been losing wetlands at a mind-blowing rate. And we have outstanding conservation organizations like Ducks Unlimited, Ducks Unlimited Canada, and Delta Waterfowl that punch well above their weight trying to conserve wetlands in the Prairie Pothole region and throughout the nesting grounds. But I don't know if it's enough. I'm super grateful for their work. I'm probably the biggest fan they have, both Delta and Ducks Unlimited. But when we have super dry winters and super dry springs, we can have all the easements that we want up there. But if there's no water in them, then the duck factories are shut down. So I think the waterfowler is going to have to reckon with not only the loss of habitat up north, but the tremendous impact that changing agricultural practices has had up and down all the flyways. So that's on the natural resources side. On the people side, especially as waterfowlers, we're going to have a reckoning with how we utilize social media and whether it is creating an environment that future outdoorsmen even want to engage in. Is the environment that we're creating on social media, to put it a different way, representative as a whole of our community? I don't think that it is. And oftentimes I find on social media really good examples of the worst parts of us. And that, to someone approaching the sport either as an adult or approaching the sport as a as the father or the mother of a child that's interested in it, it's real easy for them to say, like, yeah, I want nothing to do with that. And how we do that in a way that is really from the grassroots up in an organic way is going to be really difficult.
Yeah, you bring up an interesting topic, because I think a lot of really good, true-hearted sportsmen and women that go do everything the right way, you know, either teach a hunter ed class or, you know, as a mentor to someone down the street, they typically won't post something on social media because they don't want to upset a friend or whatever out of respect. And you kind of alluded to some of those people that are posting things that are negative to the hunting community, could definitely hurt hunters in the long term. But it is interesting, because we see a lot of new people, young and adults, that get into it strictly through social media, either, you know, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, where we've had lots of kids come to our camps where both parents are anti firearm. not gun owners themselves, but for whatever reason, they had an open enough mind to send their kid to one of our camps for the weekend to learn gun safety and to hunt. So, I mean, it's an odd double-edged sword because there's a lot of good there, and then there's also could be, depending on the hunter or the angler or whoever it may be, some bad as well. But it's not going away, you know. So it's one of those things that's going to be interesting to navigate, you know, going in the future. So
yeah, and it is 100% an incredibly compelling way to attract people for the right reasons. It is a very effective teaching tool. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've watched YouTube videos as I've tried to push myself in the outdoors, and I've been doing this since I was probably six. But at the same time, you have to wonder whether people trying to assimilate themselves into a social media tribe is influencing how they're actually behaving on the wildlife management area or out on the water. And that kind of loop between observing something on social media, then behaving in that way in real life, only so you can go back to social media and validate yourself. That loop is something that we've never really tackled before as a hunting community.
Yeah, no, I've talked about it. I have the same mentality as you. I've talked about it on this podcast about social media. I don't have it other than Facebook to keep make sure CWA is posting what we're supposed to be posting, but I keep my stuff tight to the chest, and not because I'm going to post anything inappropriate, but I see, you know, the worst of the worst. I get it from friends and stuff, and it's refreshing seeing that you, somebody in that position, recognizes that also, because I don't think a lot of people have seen it yet as that is a potential threat to our heritage and what it can do to turn people away.
Yeah.
So talking about, you know, next generation and what they see and what they view, what's one piece of advice you'd give to the next generation of hunters and conservationists? What would it be?
Yeah. I would say two things. And for people that aren't watching this conversation on camera, I'm 38 years old. I'm not a boomer, but there might be some young people out there that call me one. I would say two things, and I feel 30 years older than I actually am saying it, but I think the most important thing that the next generation can do is actively and uncomfortably pursue somebody to take with you when you go out. Even if you're just going to scout, even if you don't think you're going to kill anything, because CWA is a super important organization. So is the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. But ultimately, we're not going to be able to replenish and retain the number of outdoorsmen that our sports need to continue and thrive without organic human-to-human relationships that are built around chasing wild things in wild places. So that's the biggest thing. I got into hunting because I had a dad that knew how to do it, that loved it. And the only thing that he loved more than being outdoors was being outdoors with me. And as demographics across the United States continue to change, it's going to be incumbent on us to get outside of our comfort zones to ask that neighbor, hey buddy, you want to go ride through the woods in the middle of the dark with me in the morning? Right. So there's no way that you can have enough CWAs or Arkansas Game and Fish Commissions to replace that kind of important organic relationships. The second thing that I would say to the next generation is open a book. Open a book and learn about our conservation past, and it'll humble you about how much we've inherited from generations that have sacrificed so much. Conservation is always about delaying instant gratification for the long-term future. It's always short-term sacrifice for long-term reward. And to the extent that things are really great for us right now, it's because people in generations past have made sacrifices to make that happen. If it's not good for us right now, then chances are it's because people in the past didn't make the sacrifices that they should have. And the more people can read about our culture as sportsmen, the sacrifices that were made or weren't made, the better we will be able to understand about what we need to do in the future.
And Austin, I want to touch on, you growing up in Arkansas and the hunting culture. When you were growing up, did you guys have like a certain spot that you guys always hunted? I mean, we kind of back here is, our public ground, for the most part, not all of it, is almost a reservation system where you'd have to have a lottery to draw on. So you're hunting multiple different places, blinds, free roam, whatever. Like, your hunting culture growing up, was it a particular spot in the woods that was public ground that you kind of grew up hunting, or was it kind of going wherever opportunity provided itself?
It was more the latter. For many years growing up, my dad, he had a hunt lease, and we would go hunt public land when his lease got froze up, basically. And when we did that, we would always hunt the Cache River or the White River or the Arkansas River. So it was definitely the latter. There was not any kind of draw for any public land when I was growing up.
Is that an issue today, even where like some of the public grounds where it's public, but it might be, Bill's family's hunted that hole for 50 years and it's kind of theirs, where we get that on our public ground where it's like, this is my spot. And we're like, no, this is everyone's land and I beat you to it. I've read some articles where, like some people are, grandfathered into some of the, some of these areas where, once they die, that blind then goes back to a public draw or something like that. Is that part of, the hunting culture back there too, where you have these areas that technically might be public ground, but like it's known to this family hunts it or these people from wherever? Is that a thing?
Yes, that I would say was probably more common in certain parts of the state, probably 10, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say the more attention that public land continues to draw, there is more and more consensus that privatization of public lands is a bad thing. Now, that is the administration perspective of like how we administer public lands. But oftentimes people try to treat the actual root of the problem, which is ethics and the eroding character of many of our outdoorsmen, they try to treat that and fix that problem through a draw. And they're like, oh, well, we have all these ethical problems, so we just need to restrict access for everybody, and that's going to fix it. This is up to the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission now without me. There might be a compelling case for a draw, but I hope it's not ethics, because that is just punishing a whole lot of people for the conduct of a few. Yes, there was a time in Arkansas Game and Fish history where there were families that had multi-generational blinds that they hunted and that only they hunted on certain wildlife management areas, but that's no longer the case. And the more and more attention that our public lands have, the less appetite there is for that kind of privatization.
Gotcha. Yeah, makes sense. What is your most memorable waterfowl hunting experience growing up? Do you have one in particular that stands out? I mean, we back here, you know, when people ask, where do you want to go? It's flooded timber in Arkansas, right? I mean, like, I think that's every duck hunter's dream that I know of, is to at least do it one time, because we have flooded trees and stuff back here and oaks and river bottoms, but I don't think it's the same.
I do. Yeah. It was awesome. My dad and I and my brother, we used to hunt at this club right off the White River. It was flooded timber, and the White River was out of its banks. It was going to be a clear blue morning. We didn't really get to see the sun in the trees because we were done so quick. but we had about six or seven guys with us. It was on Christmas break. I would have been in college. My brother was on Christmas break in high school. And that was the last time the three of us hunted together. And it was just the perfect morning. And it was one of the, you know, one of the fairy tale kind of Arkansas flooded timber mornings, where when the ducks start coming in and you're on the X, it's just like you're at the bottom of an escalator and there's just nothing but ducks coming in, and there's nothing that you can do to stop it.
That's awesome.
I mean, we were shooting and we were shooting in between laughs and us reloading, because we just couldn't believe. I mean, I think somebody may have called for cumulatively 90 seconds. but it was awesome. We were laughing so hard. We were having such a good time. We could really reload, but it was a beautiful morning. We got a great picture. We were home early. Shouldn't say we. My dad scored some brownie points because my mom couldn't believe that we were home so early. But yeah, that was the last time that the three of us got to hunt flooded timber together.
Nice. Have you hunted California yet?
I have not, but let me tell you, I've heard some great, great things.
I was going to say, now that you're with Bandit and our relationship with Chad, you'll probably be coming out next year.
Out. Experience it.
I would love to. Probably another thing that changed in Arkansas during the 15 years that I was gone was we got specs.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I love hunting those bar bellies, and would love to come to California to do it, as well as ducks.
What's your limit on specs?
I was going to say, don't you guys get like three or something?
Yeah, how many specs can you shoot?
Two.
Two? Yeah, we get 10.
Yeah, and you're the envy.
Yeah. You guys have the mallards and the timber, and we have the specs.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's for sure. Do you guys ever get, like, other birds coming through the timber, or is it primarily only mallards and, like, wood ducks? Do you get widgeon and things like that, or is that pretty odd?
Yeah, I would say predominantly it's mallards and wood ducks.
Okay.
There's obviously exceptions to that. I've killed a Canada goose in the timber.
That's awesome.
Shufflers, widgeon, teal, pintail, but very rare.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
But even like out in the rice blinds, it's still predominantly mallards, or do you guys shoot the other birds?
No, you have a much higher variety.
Okay.
In the fields. I mean, I went duck hunting with my oldest daughter, I don't know, early to mid January. And we almost limited out with a group of four, but we only killed one mallard. I mean, it was pintail, teal. Even that late, we were still killing teal, you know, gadwall, widgeon.
That's probably real similar. It sounds like us. Yeah. Well, Austin, we really appreciate you coming on today, kind of telling us your story and kind of where Bandit's going. And we obviously really appreciate all the support that Bandit Holdings has provided with California waterfowl, from decoys every year, jackets,
waiters
for our waiter room. Those are waiters that get used by youth, kids, veterans, etc. You guys always have been a huge supporter of our program. So, you know, as the someone that leads that program, I just want to say thank you so much. It helps out an absolute ton. And thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thank you for what y'all do in California. Y'all are such a good example for so many, and we wish we had a CWA in every state in our country. Thank you for having me on. I've enjoyed the conversation, and hopefully we'll get to chase something wild soon.
Appreciate it. Awesome, thanks, Austin.
Awesome. We appreciate it.
Hey, and you better come out this year and hunt with us, son. Put it on the calendar.
How close are y'all to Napa Valley?
Carson lives there.
I live in
Napa
Valley.
You want to go drink some wine? He's your guy.
I'm going to bring my wife.
Yeah,
but yes.
My wife works in the wine industry, so I usually take people out.
All right. When is the best time to come for wine and birds?
Wine doesn't have a date on it. Any time for wine. Birds, this last couple of years has been December, has been really good.
Yeah, usually December, January is pretty hard to beat. Just don't come during a full moon and you'll be all right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, but Carson's...
That's right.
Carson's got you set. He's taken a bunch of football players and all that good stuff out.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, I'll see y'all in December then.
Appreciate it. Sounds good. Thanks, Austin. We appreciate it.
All right.
Nice meeting you.
All right. See y'all. Bye.
Wait.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.